Izzy Judd, and welcome to my podcast, Let's Talk Fertility. This podcast is sponsored by Pregnacare. During my own fertility treatment and pregnancies, I was recommended to take specialist vitamins and minerals to support my nutritional needs. There are many benefits to taking these supplements, and they also made me feel like I was taking a proactive approach to prepare myself and my body as best I could. Pregnacare Conception and Wellman Conception vitamin and mineral supplements provide advanced nutritional support for men and women trying for a baby, including zinc, vitamin D, and the exact levels of folic acid recommended for women by the UK Department of Health. Pregnacare, expert nutritional care while trying for a baby. To find out more, visit www.pregnacare.com. My guest today is award-winning journalist Sophie Beresina. Sophie is the beauty director of Elle magazine, a columnist at the Times newspaper, and founder of home decor brand Number 22 Candles. At the age of 31, Sophie was diagnosed with breast cancer and went on to document her recovery on a popular blog, Sophie Feels Better. 6 years later, Sophie discovered that chemotherapy had made her infertile. Having gone through multiple rounds of IVF using egg donation and suffering two devastating miscarriages, Sophie is now on the path to motherhood through surrogacy. Sophie's weekly column for the Times newspaper, The Mother Project, gives readers a true insight into surrogacy and what it really feels like to go through infertility, both subjects that need more awareness and understanding. Sophie writes with such heart, humour and honesty, and I feel very honoured to have the chance to talk to Sophie today and share her inspirational and brave story with you all. So welcome, Sophie.
Thank you.
I got your surname right.
You did. You got it right first time. Well done.
So Beresina, where's your dinner?
Yeah, that's how you remember.
Well, thanks so much for coming along today and talking to us. I know that the listeners are going to find great comfort from listening to you talk. But I just wondered, my goodness, where to start, because you have been through so much. But I guess going back, when you were diagnosed with breast cancer at 31, is that right?
Yeah.
What was going on in your life at the time?
Well, I had just moved in with my boyfriend, now husband, I'm happy to say. We literally moved in together a week before and we just got kittens.
Kittens, how many?
Yes,
are we
had two.
Okay.
And that was like my life dream.
Right, okay.
Move in with someone, have my lovely little kittens. And then, yeah, we'd been together a week and then I found a lump in my breast and I just thought that it wouldn't be anything because this is me we're talking about. And it was big and also it hurt when I pressed it. And I'd read everywhere that if you find a lump and it's cancerous, it doesn't hurt.
Oh, really?
So I wasn't concerned. My doctor wasn't concerned. She thought it was a cyst. Because I'm young as well to have had cancer. And I went for a biopsy and then it came back that it was positive, unfortunately, and then everything fell apart. But the first thing was the nurse talks you through, you know, what you have to do and how you have to change your lifestyle to deal with the chemo. And she said, no animals. You can't be near animals because the medicine like lowers your immune system. So there's a risk of infection and septicemia even. And I was just like, I can't not have animals. They make me feel better.
Yeah.
And so I was really adamant that I'd keep them and they absolutely did make me feel better. And
really?
They never scratched me.
So you kept the kittens?
Absolutely. They were like my little companions the whole time. It was brilliant.
They have an amazing intuition,
yeah,
animals, don't
absolutely.
They just know.
Yeah.
So obviously you've documented about everything that you went through with breast cancer, but relating it to fertility.
Mm-hmm.
At what point did you find out that the cancer treatment had an effect on fertility?
So I have been on remission therapy after my cancer treatment for 5 years. And the plan was that then I would be able to start having a family because it down-regulates everything. And unfortunately, when I started my treatment, I wasn't offered the option to freeze my eggs. So for a young woman going through cancer, that should always be an option. And I just assumed that my treatment needed to start really quickly. I don't know if I would have chosen to do it anyway, but I should have been presented the option. So that is something that was kind of weighing on my mind the whole time.
At the point, obviously, when you were diagnosed, was mm-hmm. that on your radar? Was it even something you were thinking about? Or
No. Because it was such a shock, and I was just terrified, to be honest. So I just really wanted to put myself in the hands of
the doctors
who could help me. And that's something that I've come to learn. Like, you just want to trust someone who knows more than you, so you just kind of just let them take over. And it was just something that I have thought about since, and my family thought about since, and everyone I've spoken to has said, oh no, you should have had that option, including the hospital that I transferred to. So I'd say it's become a regret, but I maintain that I don't know if I would have decided to delay treatment to do that.
Yeah. So would the hospital kind of admit that it had been an error of theirs, or do you think it was just that their priority was to get the treatment going for breast cancer? Was that sort of...
I don't know. I think that's a really difficult question, because in my heart I feel like it was an error. And there were other errors. But, you know, this is just my journey. And now I've come to learn so much more about it. But when I came to finishing my remission therapy, and I made it clear that I wanted to start a family, my doctor said that being young, the chemo doesn't, you know, it should be okay. You've got a really high chance that it won't affect your fertility, because you had it young and you beat the cancer and everything should be fine. So I went.
I see.
Yeah. But it turned out that they did a study that I had to be on the drugs for 10 years rather than the 5 years that most people are on. I'm being treated at the Royal Marsden, and they're always doing studies. So when I went for my last scan, and I was really excited because it was all finishing and I was going to get back to normal life, they said, oh, yeah, we've done this great thing, and so you have to be on the drugs for another 5 years. So we made an agreement that I would have a year gap to try and have a family, and we would try IVF because it controls the situation more, instead of, you know, trying naturally, and that maybe that could take a year on its own.
Of course, yeah.
So then I went and had the scans straight away to check everything, my ovarian function and the blood tests and everything, and it came back that there was no ovarian function. In fact, one of my ovaries wasn't even visible, and so I was diagnosed as infertile.
So at that point, when you were given that diagnosis, how long did it take you to think to yourself, right, I've just got to get on with this and accept the cards that have been dealt? You know, did you have a point where you allowed yourself to feel really upset, or did you just think, no, I've just got to get on?
Yeah, that's a good question. I have got this really weird thing that I've come to realise, that I think I process things like within 3 days.
Okay.
It's really weird. And I have a friend who is very into kind of alternative medicine and spiritual healing and things. And she's like, you have to give yourself time to grieve, and you're allowed to feel sad. And I do that. You know, I was really shocked with that diagnosis, and it felt awful. And I remember my husband was trying to cheer me up in the I just felt like this is another doctor's appointment with bad news that I can't deal with. And he said, oh, you've been through worse. You know, you can get through this. You've been through worse. And I remember that I recognised that he was really trying to help, and that was a youthful sentiment. But at that time, I was so angry, because I was like, this isn't fair. I've been through something different that was, you know, threatening my life, but this is threatening my future, and it's a different thing to process. And I think I cried for a day. We were given the option of trying to have babies with donor eggs, which is a really amazing progressive thing that you can do. So I cried for a day. The second day, I thought, that is repulsive. The thought of having a baby with donor eggs, I couldn't understand it, but it just felt repulsive to me. I really wanted to get on board with it, but the thought of carrying essentially someone else's baby that's mixed with my husband's DNA felt so weird. And then the next day I woke up and I was like, oh my God, that is amazing that you can actually carry someone else's baby mixed with your husband's DNA. And I was so excited.
Sophie, that is so brave of you to say, admit completely how it made you feel.
Yeah.
Because I think it's almost, people might be afraid to admit And I think that's why your column's so warm and honest, because you're saying, this is actually how I felt.
Mm.
But also, 3 days, that's pretty good going.
Yeah.
From, you know, being told, you know, pretty much the hardest thing that you're going to be told from a doctor to, right, what is the next step? What am I going to do?
I think maybe because I had been through, I think he was right, my husband, I had been through essentially worse, you know, thinking that you might not survive something is different, but it's a real strong, terrible kind of situation to deal with. And I think because I did this thing, I toughened up and I thought, okay, you know, I got through that, I can do that, I can do this. But I don't know if I internalise things, I don't know. I just seem to be able to pick myself up and get on with it, because what is the point of not doing that?
Do you think because of what you went through with battling cancer, it changed your perspective?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think it was such a shock and such a surprise, and no one in my family has suffered from cancer. And even now when I go for checkups, the doctors are like, oh no, you were so young, I'm so sorry, which is kind of encouraging, but also a little bit like, oh, that wasn't fair, because it was unusual. But yeah, it's taught me to just deal with more difficult situations, and I suppose I'm not so easily shocked now.
Yeah. And do you think that that's a real change in your personality? Were you like that before, or do you think that's something that's changed since everything?
I think, to be perfectly honest, I haven't had to go through anything terrible before that happened. You know, like, my parents are still together and super loving and amazing. I've got a lovely sister who's got her own family. I fell in love with someone and got married, and we had lovely kids. And we just, you know, the worst thing that happened to me, I hadn't even had a filling until I was diagnosed with cancer. I was scared of blood tests. That was about as bad as it was. And now I'm like, I can deal with any injection. It's fine.
Once you'd got over the fact that you were actually going to go ahead with IVF using egg donation, mm-hmm. was your husband on board? Did he agree? Did he share similar feelings to you?
Yeah, he's been amazing, because this is a big loss for him as well. And I think a lot of people maybe forget that there are other people going through this, you know, with me, because he has lost something in a different way. He has to grieve that as well. But all the focus is on making sure I'm okay and making sure I can get through this. So it's real teamwork. Mm. But we've got the same goal, and we want to have a family, and we have decided together that we'll do it by whatever means. Mm. So whilst it's not his ideal, you know, he wants to have a baby with me, like all couples do. He wants to see mine and his child grow up and see me in their features and things, but he's adapted just like I have.
Mm.
And he's really excited too.
So at the point you decided to go ahead with egg donation, did any friends or family at that point step forward and want to help with egg donation?
Yeah, so funnily enough, my sister did step forward a while ago, before all this happened, when I was having chemo, and offered to donate her eggs, which to me felt like the perfect solution, because she's the closest to me DNA-wise. She'd offered this amazing thing. I went to speak to a doctor about it, a fertility doctor, who told me that it was very unusual for someone to use a sibling's eggs, and
really,
it was surprising to me. And he actually said, like, he has never worked on a case where they've used a sibling's eggs, because we'd all have to have counselling. All three of us would have to have separate counselling and then joint counselling, and it would have to go before, I think it's a medical board of ethics or something, because there's a lot of emotion tied up with that, and a lot of situations that might be difficult, like, for instance, Christmas, when the whole family's together, and maybe my child would run to my sister if, you know, they get bored of their mums and everyone else is really exciting. So I went away thinking, okay, that's not what people do. And again, since then, I'm not sure if that was the best and right advice. But it turns out it was right for us, because my husband found it weird.
I really
the thought of having a child essentially with my sister.
Yeah. So what is the process of egg donation? How do you begin?
Okay, so you need to find a donor, obviously. So there are lots of different regulations in different countries. And in the UK, where obviously it would be ideal to do it, there tends to be quite a long waiting list, because there were regulations that came in fairly recently, I think in the last 5 years, that an egg donor couldn't be anonymous. So any child born by an egg donor would have a right by the time they reach 16 to search for the donor on a database and essentially find out who that is. And I think that it just puts a different spin on things, doesn't it? I think imagine if a sperm donor had people knocking on their door when they were 16 left, right and centre, it would be a bit more difficult. So I think the pool dried up quite quickly in the UK, so it was harder to find someone. My doctor told me it'd be about a 2-year waiting list, and obviously I didn't have that time. So we looked into other options, and there are various different regulations, but we went for Russia because actually Berezina, which you did pronounce correctly, well done, it's actually like Berezinia or something because it's a Russian name.
Right.
So I have Russian heritage, and it made more sense to go to Russia where there isn't a waiting list, and it was quite a lot less expensive over there. So it seemed like the right thing to do at the time.
And how do they make matches with donors?
So it's basically physical appearance. So it can be as detailed as height, weight. You know, you can go into education. You can try and do as close a match as possible, or you can be brown eyes, brown hair, slim-ish build.
Right, okay.
Which is why Russia made sense, because I actually have a slight Russian look. So if you're trying to find someone who is closest to me in appearance, then, you know, that's kind of the process. And they do it differently in different countries. So in America, you can choose your own donor if you want to. In Spain, you absolutely can't, and the doctor does it for you. And in Russia, I think it's either way, but we didn't want to get into that much detail, so we asked the doctor to match for us.
So was the doctor in Russia?
Yes.
So how did you find a doctor in Russia?
So there are clinics in London that have partners in different countries to help you.
Okay.
So we initially, well, I had never been to Russia, surprisingly. I think maybe I went when I was about 9 with my family, but since then. So we went, actually, we ended up going 8 times in a year to St. Petersburg. And we started off with one clinic and it didn't really work out. Found another one and then we started the journey with him.
Okay. So did you do much for yourself holistically around IVF treatment?
Yes, because when I was being treated in London, my amazing doctor recommended this acupuncturist called Emma Cannon, who I know you've spoken to. But he said to me, she makes my work better. And I just thought that is such an amazing, for a doctor to say.
Yeah.
That's really amazing. And I went to meet with her. She's a fertility expert and we just really clicked. She was actually amazing at calming me down, giving me hope and encouragement and just this whole different holistic approach. It was really helpful.
Because she's been on the podcast. Mm. And I've always really admired her whole view on fertility and actually looking at people as a whole for us all to live a fertile life, whatever it is, whether that's trying for a baby or not, how can we be the best we can be? And I think being around somebody like that when you're going through, you know, for IVF or just to look after yourself emotionally and physically, I know the benefits are huge. Did you find you were able to be a bit more relaxed?
Yeah,
kind of post-treatment?
She was the best. The best thing about her was that she is so normal, and she was like, have a glass of wine. Like, it's not going to do anything to you. It'll make you feel better. Just have a really good glass of wine. And, you know, swear if you want to. And she was just really encouraging in so many ways.
Yeah.
And amazingly, I don't know if you want to put this in because it's about periods, but I'll say it anyway.
Go for it.
When I had my scan, they were like, your left ovary, we can't even see it. You know, everything is just shut down. And I had 2 sessions with her and I got a period. And I was really worried about what this was. And I went to my doctor and I was, oh my God, something's happening. I've got this bleeding. What's going on? And he said, oh, you've got a period. And I was like, what? I haven't had a period for 6 years. And he said, have you been to see Emma Cannon? And I was like, yeah. And he said, how many times? I said, twice. And he said, yeah, that'll be it.
Wow.
And then I had a scan and I had that ovary had reappeared and there were follicles.
Wow, that is amazing.
Amazing. So donor IVF essentially is the same as IVF, but you have to sort of prepare my uterus mm-hmm. for another egg to come in.
Preparing yourself for IVF and going into all that process, how did you mentally feel? Because obviously it's a huge thing for anybody to go through. But having experienced the treatments you've done with cancer, were there any parallels? Was there anything that sort of emotionally came up that kind of took you by surprise?
I think mostly it was a pressure, a feeling of pressure to like, for it to work and to be able to do it, because no one made me feel this way, but it just felt like it was my fault that, you know, that I can't have children and I have to deprive my husband of the ideal scenario. But I know it's not my fault. No one made me feel like that, but you do just feel this irrational guilt. And then I think going and having the treatment is such an amazing option, and there's so much hope involved. So then there's an element of pressure to do it right, which is funny because I'm not really doing anything except, you know, eating well and looking after myself. But I treated it like I was sort of studying for an exam or something.
Yeah. And you're right. There is that. There's this amazing hope because there's possibility. Mm. But then there is that pressure when you get to the 2-week wait.
God, the 2-week wait.
Yeah. Where you're suddenly like, it's up to me.
Yeah.
My body now.
You know. And you're so careful. I remember like walking really carefully.
No, I know. I couldn't get off the bed.
Yeah.
When they did the transfer, I was like, I'm not moving.
Yeah. I had to fly home after transfer because of doing it in Russia, which felt so wrong. But all the doctors involved in England and Russia said, no, it's fine. There's no study that says you can't get on an aeroplane, but it just felt really wrong.
Yeah. Was there anything that you did to kind of help you cope through those 2 weeks during the wait?
I went to stay with my parents for a bit because I was like, you know, sometimes you just want someone to look after you and not be exposed to any kind of, I don't know, arguments or anything normal that happens in day-to-day life. I tried to just be as normal as possible and not think about it, but that's impossible.
It's impossible, isn't it? It takes up every waking moment. And there's something kind of amazing when you feel like there's actually life inside, like the possibility.
Yeah.
Even if it was just for those 2 weeks.
Yeah, exactly.
Just to have that feeling. Did you feel connected after transfer? Like, did you have that feeling of, like, a spark of...
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, because I think you really humanise them as well, especially if you create an embryo in a different way, but there's other people involved. And, you know, it's so strange to get a phone call and say, oh, yeah, you've got 5 embryos and they're really good and now they're going to be put in a freezer until you're ready to put them in your uterus. Like, that is the weirdest thing.
I know.
I felt emotionally attached to them when I got that phone call and they were in Russia. Yeah. I had this really weird surge of love, which I wasn't expecting. And I was like, God, they're so cool. And come on, little guys, you know, you're going to do really well. So every time they put one in, it felt like my baby. It didn't feel like an embryo. So, and also, unfortunately, the Russian, I think it was a breakdown in communication or translation, but they kept telling me what sex it was when they did the embryo transfer. And that is really difficult because then you really think, if it doesn't work, you know.
So you had 5 rounds.
Yes.
And you knew each time the sex of...
Yeah. Well, they told... Yeah, I had sort of different doctors doing it and they kept telling me. I kept saying, no, I don't want to know.
Don't want to know. Yeah. I can understand that because then you put even more identity on. Yeah.
Yeah, so that was a real shame. But... And then obviously the first one didn't work and then that was really heartbreaking. Because it felt... I don't know, it just had more onus on the fact that I knew what sex it was.
Mm. So, devastatingly, you had 2 miscarriages. Mm-hmm. How did you feel you could take a deep breath and go back and go again? Was there anything that you did to kind of help you get back in that headspace?
It was just that feeling of... I know every time it didn't happen, I was absolutely destroyed and I just thought, I can't do this. Like, the treatment is uncomfortable, the travelling is awful, the pressure is terrible, I can't deal with the loss and the hope and all of that stuff. And then as soon as I think about not doing it, I think, no, because the next one might be the one, and then everything is worth it. And also the thought that they're there, my embryos are there and waiting for me. I just felt like I couldn't stop.
So you gave all five a go?
Yeah.
And so after that, you decided, right, was that within the year kind of gap?
I actually had six embryos, but I had to stop trying because I only had a year and I'd gone over the year. So my hospital were really keen for me to get back on the treatment. So I had to actually just call it a day then and stop. And in a way, it was, I remember being really upset at the time because I was like, what if the next one is, you know, the same feeling the whole way through, but at the same time, slightly relieved because someone else made the decision for me.
Yeah, that's it. Because in many ways, your whole experience has been dictated to for you rather than you having the choice.
Yeah.
Which must be incredibly difficult and must bring up so many different emotions. But as you're saying then, you didn't have to make that decision.
Yeah. I think it was dictated to us in terms of what my circumstances were, but everyone's got so many options in that scenario. And I know loads of people who have, you know, had one round and then decided that if that didn't work, it wasn't meant to be. And some people who write to me who've done it 12, 15 times, you know, with their own eggs and are reluctant to try donor eggs. Everyone is so different. So we definitely had options, but I don't know, we did what we could in that time. So then for to be able to stop was strangely a relief.
A relief. So how long was it between stopping and deciding you were going to go down the surrogacy route?
It was about the same time. I just didn't, you know, I needed something to feel like I was progressing. And I remember both the times that I got pregnant, my first thought was, oh, we don't have to do surrogacy.
Really?
Yeah. It was really weird. Oh, amazing, I can do this and this is how it was meant to be and we don't have to do that.
Had you looked into surrogacy then during...
I think we thought of it as a backup plan because every time, you know, there's a real strong chance that it won't work. So no one wants to think, well, then that's it. So I think we just always wanted something else in case that didn't happen. And that was the case for the whole way through, you know. If we can't do it ourselves, then we've always got donor eggs, and we can't do donor eggs, we've always got surrogacy. So, yeah, we just knew that, and we just know that we need to be a family and
whatever it
raise
takes.
Children, yeah.
Did you speak to many friends about what you were going through?
Not really, because sometimes I think that this isn't me that this is happening to, because it's so, like, hearing you sum everything up at the beginning is really weird for me, because it's like, God, that person sounds pretty strong.
Yeah.
And God, they went through a lot. But when you've been through it over a long period of time, you just deal with it. You just deal with the hand you're dealt. So I'm really conscious, and this sounds a bit weird, but I'm really conscious of boring people with my drama.
Really? You see it like that? You feel that?
But it's
for
just because it's been going on so long since cancer, you know. Like, I think people think when you stop having treatment for cancer, then everything's fine and you're back to normal. And it really wasn't for me. It was, you have to adjust so much and you have to deal with the whole load. It's almost harder afterwards because you're not in anyone's care. Mm. So you have to deal with so many things then. And that was 6 years.
Yeah.
I could have talked to someone about that every day. Mm. But that would have been really boring.
But also, you're young and there's so many other things going on, and you're amazing in what you're doing with your work and your job, and, you know, there's so much else about you that I guess you just didn't want to be labelled as that person.
Yeah, exactly. That's hit the nail on the head. Thanks, Izzy.
But also because I think that, you know, even with fertility, people often, they don't want to talk about it. Well, it is very personal, but also... there never seems to feel like the right time to talk about it.
And what to say. And because also most of my friends have got children. And a lot of people I know have done IVF. And, you know, it's a bit difficult to talk to them because unless you've done donor eggs or gone down surrogacy, it's a very difficult thing to wrap your head around because it's really different.
Mm. But that's because it's not spoken about, and
there's
very little awareness about it.
Yeah, I mean, I'd love people to feel like they can talk to me about it, Because surrogacy is very interesting. Journalistically, I'm fascinated by the whole thing. And I'm happy to talk about it as I'm here.
So tell me about it. What is it with when you set off down the surrogacy route? Where did you begin? How did you...
So again, we went back to our London doctor and said that we wanted to do surrogacy. And he gave us a lot of advice about where to do it. And because we'd been through a bit of a difficult time in Russia and we obviously, unfortunately, spent a lot of money on the donor egg IVF that didn't work, we wanted to make sure that we had the best possible chance with surrogacy and we wanted to do it right. Mm-hmm. So we decided to do it in America for lots of reasons.
Why did you rule out the UK? I know that the laws in the UK...
That was the main thing. I actually spoke to my husband about this yesterday because since writing the column, I have had quite a lot of people come to me and tell me about their amazing UK surrogacy stories and offering to connect me with people who help them, which is amazing. And I'm really happy that people tell me that stuff because that's research. Mm-hmm. And it's research that I wasn't able to access at the time. But yes, the laws in the UK are archaic. They need to be changed. And there are several things that make it really difficult. For one, you're not allowed to pay a surrogate, which I do agree with. I'm on board with that because the idea of commercialising something like this is difficult. But you can pay reasonable expenses. And that's to kind of determine between the surrogate and the intended parents, which is what you're called. Mm-hmm. But it means that it's difficult to regulate and you can't advertise, so you can't find someone. So unless you know someone who's willing to do it, there is a very long waiting list.
Right.
Because obviously there are more intended parents than surrogates. But the main problem for me is one, that the birth certificate is a bit unusual because the surrogate would be the mother on the birth certificate. Whether it was my eggs or a donor eggs that we used, she would be the mother. And if she's married, her husband would be the father, which blows my mind. So even though it's my husband's sperm, he would be the father. But the thing that's the, you know, we could get around that. You can apply for a parental order and that can be changed. The birth certificate can't be, but you are the parents. Mm-hmm. The most frightening thing is that there's no contract that can be enforced in a court of law. So you can draw up agreements, but they're not enforceable. And the surrogate can change her mind up to 6 weeks after the birth. So just to have that hanging over someone, I think is really difficult.
Yeah.
And we just decided that we'd been through so much already and so much let down, disappointments and bad news that we just were like, right, let's just do it in the, you know, inverted commas, gold standard, which is America, which is really highly regulated. And as such, very, very expensive.
So when you made that decision, was it your doctor in the UK that then linked you with clinics in America?
No, we actually did we did a lot of our own research. There are so many different rules in America as well. Different states have different...
It's a full-time job.
It really is. It really is. And my husband is like an amazing project manager. So he's very... He's all into the logistics, luckily, because I'm not. But I, you know, did some research online. I spoke to a couple who had a surrogate child. They're a gay couple, and they sent me a list of the best agencies for same-sex parents. And we kind of just whittled it down. We had a few Skype meetings we spoke to about five different agencies and settled on the one that we just felt the most connection with.
Yeah. I guess you just kind of have to go with your gut at some point.
Yeah.
So do they then set about sorting out a profile for you?
So you have to, it's really funny, it's like my single friend. You have to fill out a profile, but essentially you're kind of, you know, you're selling yourself to someone who, because in America, even though it's much more prevalent, there is still more intended parents than surrogates. So at my agency, there's 60 intended parents to every one surrogate. So they're having to kind of make a choice. So you fill out a profile. There's a funny section where your husband has to fill out a bit about you and you have to fill out a bit about your husband, which is, you know, it's quite nice. It's quite nice to do that with your partner. And then that profile gets submitted to surrogates and then they choose who they want to work with.
So it's really their choice over yours in that when a surrogate gets presented, you just say yes.
You don't have to.
No, but...
So you read the profile and you decide. You have lots of things in there that help you kind of be more aligned. So religion is quite a big thing because we're not religious, but in the US, you know, there are lots of people who will only work with devout Christians, say, or will only work with Americans. So, so you're matched like that initially, and then you're presented with a surrogate and you can decide if you want to proceed or not. Obviously, we always wanted to proceed.
Yeah.
And then you have a Skype meeting, which is like a job interview. It's really funny.
Yeah. So I love how you always find humour in it. And one in particular in your column when you say, you have to say to your dad, keep up, dad. Yeah. Like, there's an egg donor, there's a surrogate.
I've had to draw him like a Venn diagram of how it all works so that he can refer to it. But it's confusing, I get it. If you're not in it, there's so many different people involved. And that, you know, there's so many different appointments and medical processes. It's confusing.
Yeah, it is confusing. Mm. And also for husbands and partners, learning about the reproductive system is also very difficult. And
it's something very difficult.
Harry and you call your husband Mr. B in your column. So Harry and Mr. B will connect on that. I loved it when you were talking about he got the ninth trimester in these 9 months.
It was ridiculous, but it's really good because we'll be having a serious conversation about it and about our concerns and how it's all going to go, and then he'll drop something like that and I just crack up, and then he gets offended and then he laughs straight away.
Has humour been something that you've kept going all of this?
I think it just helps me. Mm. Because I'm a journalist, maybe I look at it from the outside in as well. Mm. And it is, you know, some of it's funny. It's weird. I like an analogy as well. And so, you know, a Skype meeting's like a job interview. And and it really is. Like, if I frame things like that, I suppose it feels more familiar and funnier.
Yeah. And I guess it's almost, if you give yourself a character to play, I guess, if you know, if you're an artist or whatever, then it sort of allows you to just slightly separate yourself from the reality of it and maybe protect yourself a little bit.
And I think the way that I write, and I did the same thing with my cancer blog, is I don't want to present a negative front. I don't really see a point in that. And it helps me feel better to write it positively. Mm. Mm. And I think sometimes I do keep a diary as well and I put the sad stuff in there. And it will cross over because there are some sad times that happen.
Of course.
But I think I wrote it down in my diary that I realised that I think I pretend to be fine. Like you just said, it's like playing a character. I pretend to myself that I'm fine and this is all okay, so I don't have to be honest about how sad I really feel about it.
Do you feel that... I mean, surely going through all of this has an impact on your whole mental health because of everything you're having to cope with and manage. Have you experienced anything?
I mean, I have. I think maybe because I pretend to myself that everything's fine, I have panic attacks quite a lot. But I did have panic attacks before. Mm. I think I'm a control freak.
Join the club.
Yeah. And those people are quite prone to panic attacks. But... you know, I managed them. I had cognitive behavioural therapy when I was younger, which is amazing, and it just teaches you techniques to be able to manage these things because it's really normal. You know, a lot of people have it. As soon as you start talking about it,
you
realise that a lot of people have issues like this. So, and I'm not surprised I'm having it again now because doing surrogacy is handing control over to someone else. Mm. Absolutely. Mm. Like, I may as well not be in the equation at this point.
Yeah.
So that is quite a difficult thing to manage.
Yeah.
And I suspect that's why I'm having them.
Yeah.
And also it's busy.
It's busy. Yeah, you're trying to manage a full-time job and everything else going on.
Yeah.
So on your surrogate journey so far, obviously you are documenting it all in your column. You're on to your third surrogate.
Yes, it's been bumpy.
Can you give a slight sort of guidelines to what's happened?
I mean, I'm happy to be able to talk about it because I understand that this isn't how surrogacy generally goes. Everyone is different.
Mm-hmm.
But our agency in America keeps saying, oh, I'm really sorry. You know, sometimes this happens, but usually it's
right
a smoother road. So we had our first surrogate which came through quite quickly, which was really nice because they say it can take up to 6 months. And I think our first one was like 3 days, mm-hmm. which means that our My Single Friend profile was quite good.
Yeah. You nailed it.
Yeah. Thanks. so she was, I can't even remember what state she was in, but because different states have different rules.
Okay.
She had had seven children previously.
Wow.
So she'd had six of her own and then she'd been a surrogate for someone else. So we were all excited, like, that's amazing. She's done it before. She's, you know, used to pregnancy and obviously loves it. Mm-hmm. So we got really excited about that. But then our doctor, who we were assigned in Miami, is very strict and rejected her because he was worried about her health having another pregnancy, which is, you know, good. Good. It's good that he cares for her.
It's good, but I guess there's that slight, no, don't do that. We're fine. She's fine.
I know. She wants to do it. Why can't we do it? That's a definite frustration.
Yeah.
because as with any doctor, you know, he's got protocols and he goes by his own very strict rules. So we lost her, unfortunately. And then the next one took a bit longer to get there. So this whole time you're in limbo because you're like, I can't do anything. There's no progression. Mm. You're just waiting for an email of someone else to come through. So she came through and she was actually, interestingly, a psychiatrist, which I thought was really interesting because, you know, you don't know what their motivations are, but my doctor was really impressed with that because he said she's doing it because she doesn't need the money.
Mm.
You know, she'll be on a good salary. And they very rarely get physicians who want to put themselves up for this.
Mm-hmm.
But that didn't work out because once you've all agreed and had your meeting and everything, the medical records get sent to the doctor and he found that she had a history of depression.
Oh, okay.
Which is a very difficult thing with surrogacy because you're putting them at risk of being able to deal with the whole process.
Mm-hmm. And they need to protect you as well.
Yeah,
obviously.
Absolutely. Yeah.
So, okay, so we're now on to our third surrogate.
Yes.
Third time lucky. Let's
keep
everything crossed. And,
thanks.
You know, reading your column, I think it's so brave of you to open up and talk about this subject. And I think where listeners are going to get so much support is a perspective that you're bringing to fertility.
Mm.
You know, you have been dealt the worst set of cards and yet listen to you speaking with so much. You still have hope in your voice.
Oh, yeah.
You still firmly believe. You're not giving up. And I think that will give so many listeners so much strength. And
I think
you know, and I'm sure writing must be incredibly therapeutic for you.
Yeah.
And to document it all, you know, it must be lovely to have that.
Yeah. Because hopefully I can show it to my child one day when they're old enough to understand.
Exactly. And actually, you've talked about a need for a children's book.
Yeah.
And I totally agree with that, for them to understand the different routes to
There are lots of surrogacy books, but they tend to be kind of aimed for children with gay parents because that is the most, I suppose that it was the most common demographic.
It's changed so much though now, hasn't
it? Yeah, absolutely.
There's so much. Thank you so much.
You're very welcome.
For talking. I just have a couple of questions that I ask everybody at the end of the podcast. So I just wondered, looking back, what advice do you think you would give to yourself at the start of your fertility journey?
Yeah, that's a hard one, because I don't want to have regrets, but you can't help it. You know, when things go wrong, you regret that you made that kind of decision. But I always say, whenever I say that to my husband, he says, you can't regret that because you wouldn't get to this position and feel good about it. If we decided straight away to do surrogacy, I would have wondered what had happened before, you know, what I might have missed out on. So I think what advice I would give myself is to just sort of, I suppose, prepare for the unexpected.
Mm-hmm.
And it's going to cost more than you thought it would.
What is the right question to ask someone going through fertility struggles?
That's a difficult one as well. I suppose the right question is, do you want to talk about it? Or do you want to talk about something different? Mm. But do you want to talk?
Do you want to talk?
Because, rather than assuming that we want to talk, because I have had a lot of people come and tell me about, you know, oh, I did IVF and it only worked the second time and, you know, so I really understand what you're going through, you know, that kind of thing. So let's talk about it. You know, there might be a time when I really do want to talk to that person about that because it's a very similar journey at the beginning. But there are also times when I don't want to. So I think just asking what you want to talk about is probably a really good thing.
Yeah, because I think as well it's people understanding that sometimes you just need somebody to listen.
Yeah.
It's not to give you an answer.
Exactly.
But just to say, look, I'm here. If you want to talk.
Yeah.
And because I think our natural thing is to want to
help.
Find, yeah.
Which is really lovely. So then you get caught in that conversation because you don't want to say, oh, I don't want to talk about this. You want to, I suppose you want to make that person feel good as well because the human instinct is to help.
Yeah. What is the kindest thing you can do for yourself when going through fertility struggles?
Internet shopping.
Says the beauty editor.
No, I think just treating yourself, however that might be, because, and also it's really difficult, but trying to not put the pressure on yourself. Because then shopping or treating yourself or whatever is a distraction and you've earned it, like you deserve it. You deserve to eat a whole pizza that day when you've been really worrying about things without feeling guilty because you've done this massive thing, so you need to reward yourself.
That is a very good answer. What's your mantra?
I never thought that I had mantras, but I was thinking about that question and I think it's, this is tough, keep going.
This is tough, keep going.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think it's just, I know that I can't and won't give up, but I also want to appreciate the fact that it's hard and I'm doing something hard, but I'm doing it okay.
Yeah. And you must have realised that you are much stronger than you ever thought that you could be.
Yeah. And lots of people tell me that, which is really lovely. So now I'm starting to believe it.
Yeah. So just to finish, Sophie, I just do a little mindfulness exercise with everybody.
Amazing.
Just because I think people that are listening might be going through a difficult time. For you, you know, to talk about it, it's very emotional. And so it's just a little thing which I thought you could take with you.
Thank you.
So when you are waiting for those Skype calls or waiting for that email to ping through. So basically you just take your hand and we're just going to trace around our hand. Some people like to do this with their eyes closed. Other people like to do it with their eyes open. But basically, as you trace each thumb, so your thumb and then your fingers, you breathe in as you trace up and out as you go down. Mm-hmm. So if we just do it together, so we go around the thumb, breathe in. Breathe out. Up your first finger then. And out. And in. And out, in, and out, in, and out. And it just gives you a moment to take five breaths and take a pause in your day and breathe. Thanks so much, Sophie.
Thank you very much for having me. It's a pleasure to talk to you.